Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, there certainly are today many people in the world who identify themselves as Christians. It is also true that the church, and I'm talking there about the church with a capital C, the Christian church, certainly isn't the dominant religious and cultural force that in the world that it once was. However, one of our guests this morning, Reverend Charles Baer, says that that indeed may be something of a blessing in disguise, because what it does is it puts the church on the margins again, a cultural location that enables it to stand for and with most of the world's people. This morning in this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Reverend Baer about the connections between faith and social justice. He will be here spending some time in Urbana later this week. His visit is sponsored by the folks at the Illinois Disciples Foundation. And here also in the studio with me is Jen Teabji. She is the executive director and campus minister of the Illinois Disciples Foundation. And Reverend Baer is joining us by telephone. He'll be here, I think, starting tomorrow.
Yes.
Is that right? Okay. There will be a couple of events, and I will tell you about that in just a moment. Let me tell you just a little bit more about Reverend Baer. He's a retired Disciples of Christ minister. He now makes his home in California. He has held a number of ministerial posts, including University Church in Chicago and First Christian Church in St. Joseph, Missouri. He has lectured all over the world. He's published a number of works, including regular columns for the St. Joseph Gazette. He has also been involved for a long time in this effort to work for peace with justice. He's a founding member of the Disciples Justice Action Network. He's also been involved in many critical issues involving people on the margins. He served as an expert witness and consultant to the House of Representatives, their Committee on Post-Secondary Education. He's also published a number of books, including, just to mention two, Connect, Faith into Action, and A Resurrected Church, published by the Chalice Press, and that, I believe, is the most recent. There will be two events. I also want to mention them, too. On Wednesday, 7 o'clock of this week, he'll present a workshop that is free and open to the public at the Illinois Disciples Foundation, titled Bring Them to Justice, Putting Faith into Action. And one other I do want to mention, although this will be the focus here is a little bit more narrow, but on Thursday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., he'll be leading a workshop for clergy and lay leaders of local and regional denominations, that Reclaiming the Prophetic Vision. It does require you to register. There is a small fee, but
yes, just to cover expenses.
So if people are interested in that, I'm sure they can get in touch with the folks at the Disciples Foundation.
Correct.
Okay. Well, Jen, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
And here joining us by telephone is the Reverend Baer. Reverend Baer, good morning.
Good morning, Jen. Good morning, David. It's a beautiful day in California, but it always is.
Well, I appreciate you being here. I don't know if it'll be quite as beautiful when you get here, but we'll see what we can do.
We'll try.
About that. I'm interested in Reverend Baer, having you talk a little bit about this central idea in a resurrected church. And maybe then we can get on to connect that with what it is that you're going to be here to talk about. I'm very interested in this idea of the church and getting back to perhaps the place that the Christian church once held before it was such a dominant institution, and your argument that, in fact, you know, that might not be such a bad thing.
Well, you take a look at the long sweep of history, and you find wherever the church has dominated its culture, that is, it had more people than anybody else and was very powerful, it tended to go politically sour. There was never a time in American history where the church was more influential and controlled culture than in the American South prior to the Civil War. The Methodist and the Baptist churches ran the American South, and it was the citadel of segregation. You get the same thing in South Africa during the apartheid reign. The Dutch Reformed Church ran everything. So when the church has been extraordinarily powerful politically, beginning with Constantine, and that goes way back, it has tended to move way to the right and identify itself with a dominant, aggressive, and often punitive political system. When the church has been on the margins, that it is when it has been much weaker, when it has operated with people who weren't the power brokers, it has tended to be much more faithful. Hmm. That's just kind of a long look at the whole history of the Christian tradition And if you dip down in any particular century, that's what you're going to see.
Well, I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about where you see the church today, because, as I said, I would think that there would be a lot of people who would say, well, there are a lot of people in the world who identify as Christians. Certainly there are a lot of people in the United States who say that they are and who say that they believe in God. And there are a lot of people who say that they believe in God, and not all of them are Christians. So that would argue, I don't know that that would argue for any weakening of influence of the church. And so certainly today in the United States, there are a lot of churches, and there seem to be a lot of people who go to them.
It's not a matter of influence. It's a matter of what kind of influence. If you talk to most folk out in the community, at least around here, and I assume in the Midwest too, and ask them to identify who are the leading Christians, you'll get names like Robertson and Dobson and Jerry Falwell, who are all right-wing people who have bought in to a right-wing political cabal in this country. And those churches are extraordinarily powerful. If you ask who the progressives are, who the liberals are, and who their leaders are, you won't get much of an answer because nobody knows who they are. And the assumption in the general public is that all Christians are of the conservative political right. That is not true, but that's a perception. This current political administration relies as its base on these fundamentalists, that we call them evangelical Christians, to shape their policies, both domestic and foreign. Now, there are those of us who believe that that's a long way from the implications of the Christian gospel, and yet that seems to be the dominant theme in American Christian religion. It's very powerful, it's very strong, it's very central, it's very committed to this present political regime, and many of us think much ill-directed and certainly contrary to what the whole mission of Jesus was about.
How would you gauge the strength of more the people that you would identify with more progressive Christians, perhaps drawn from more mainline denominations, their strength in a time when we continue to see where the growth is seems to be among evangelicals?
If you're talking about strength as growth, that is, who has the most folk, who has more troops, certainly the progressive churches aren't in that game. But if you talk about what the faithfulness is to the gospel and how these people operate from the margins in order to get things done, terribly important. We had last night, right here in my own community, we had about 400 people at a rally, including a music concert, to end the war and bring the troops home. That'll have some effect. And all over the country now, there are growing numbers of religious people who are committed to ending the war. That's a major issue. And despite what the political administration says, these people believe that the war is immoral, is contrary to what their faith is, and will do what we can to end it. Now, that's operating from the margins. These people are not in the center. These are not the big churches. These are not the powerful religious spokesmen. These are just common ordinary people on the fringe who are taking the whole war seriously. It's the same group of people that stopped, finally, the war against Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Let me just ask one other question, and knowing how I'm sure that you will respond, but that has to do with the old question about rendering and Caesar and God, and who gets what. Some people, I suppose, would make the argument that churches as institutions are interested in moral and religious matters, and that political matters are something else entirely. And it's great to talk about social activism, I suppose, about taking care of people who need to be taken care of, and about the spiritual needs of your flock. To talk about geopolitics is something else. I suppose there are some people would say that that's not where the church should really be.
Well, that means that the people who are hungry are going to stay hungry. The people who are poor are going to be poor. The people who are caught in all kinds of injustice are going to stay that way because the church won't dirty itself to involve itself with these significant public issues. The church always has got to be concerned about the down-and-outers, about the nobodies. And to be concerned about the nobodies is a political problem. 17,000 children will die of hunger in the world today, just like 1,700 died. I'm sorry, 17,000 died today, 17,000 died yesterday. Coming up with a little food to feed some folk isn't the answer. That's a political problem. Destitution is a political problem. The fact that millions and millions of people have no health care in this country, that's a political problem. And for the church to say it's not interested in those things is to abdicate what it's all about. The church can't help but be involved in those significant issues which face human beings, just like Jesus was, just like the entire Old Testament was. And to say the church ought to keep out of that is to deny its rightful function. Now, for the church to endorse candidates, for the church to take a political stand of one party against another, that's out of bounds. But for the church to take a position on ethical issues which concern the lives of human beings is well within its orbit.
Real quick, let me introduce again our guest, the Reverend Charles Bayer. He's going to be here visiting in Champaign-Urbana later this week, his visit sponsored by the Illinois Disciples Foundation. He is someone who has been involved in social justice work for a long time. He's a retired Disciples of Christ minister. He's a founding member of the Disciples Justice Action Network. He's the author of a number of books, and the most recent is A Resurrected Church, Christianity After the Death of Christendom, published by the Chalice Press, and he will be here starting tomorrow. There will be a couple of talks, including one that's open to the public on Wednesday. Here in the studio with me, Jen Teabji. She is the executive director and campus minister of Illinois Disciples Foundation. Questions, by the way, welcome. Anybody who wants to be a part of here in the conversation, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Jen, talk a little bit about the Disciples Foundation and the kinds of things that you're interested in and how that connects with the kind of social engagement that Reverend Bayer's talking about here.
Well, I think the work that he was just talking about really speaks to the work that we do. The Illinois Disciples Foundation is the second campus ministry in the world, in the U.S., and it was the first Disciples of Christ campus ministry, and it was created with a strong legacy of social justice work. One of the important things, I think, is that is our focus, is really doing work through helping people, through giving a voice to the voiceless, working with people on the margins. It's definitely a different role than most campus ministries that you see. But what Reverend Bayer is talking about is definitely fitting in with what we work on. One of the big issues for us is the anti-war movement, working with that, because there's a strong religious voice in that on both sides, and making sure that ethically and morally, we're speaking to help the people who are not getting a voice. So we definitely are very much in line with what Reverend Bayer is talking about, and hoping when he comes this week, we'll be able to talk more about how to kind of take that faith and those beliefs and put them into a stronger practice, either within a group, yourself, congregation, whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm. So you're thinking about trying to talk to people who are, in a sense, are there already in their own minds. They've made up their minds that this is important, that their faith requires them to do certain things or wants to get them to go into certain directions. Once they've actually gotten to that point, then the idea is, how is it that you get people who are all of this, a number of people who are of that same mind, together to work together to some sort of a goal?
Well, I think that's definitely something that through the foundation, we can bring the individuals who have that kind of mindset or that desire to do this work, bring them together in a way where people can work together, because by working together definitely makes whatever movement you're working on much stronger. But we also want to work with people who have been disenfranchised from the church in whatever way, may not have, have made a decision about where they stand in terms of religious views for them and where they fit into that, because they just have had bad experiences in the past not fitting in with mainstream religion. And so we hope to be able to engage those people as well, to kind of show that there is another side to this. There is, being religious and being a moral person, working to help people, working in the margins, and trying to show that to people so they know that that's out there.
Mm-hmm. I want to turn back to the Reverend Bayer and ask if you might talk a little bit about other issues that you think people of faith ought to be engaged with. We talked about, for example, you talked about the war, and there are a lot of people all along the spectrum, politically and also in terms of what they believe, that think that that's a serious issue. Besides that, when you talk really about social engagement, when you talk about social justice, I mean, those sorts of things, I'm sure that there are might be some people that say, well, I'm not exactly sure what that means.
Let me give you an illustration.
Sure.
By the way, you talk about me being retired. I've retired three times, and I'm not retired yet. I'm a staff member of something called Progressive Christians Uniting, which is in Los Angeles, and I'm the chapter head here. And we have a fairly aggressive, although it's a small group of people, just a few thousand people who operate on these things. Now, let me give you an illustration. Let's talk about hunger. When I was in Missouri, our church, and with other churches in our area, operated a food kitchen so that we would feed 300-400 people a day. All they had to do was show up. All they had to do was be hungry. No questions were asked. They just had to show up, and we served them a meal. And we had, it's easier to raise money for hunger. I mean, people will come up with bucks for feed folk. So every year we had a big dinner of the leaders, which congratulated ourselves on what we were doing. And somebody would always say, if we fed 300 this year, we could feed 400 a day next year. And I made the speech after that every year and said, why that? Maybe it would be better if we could serve nobody. And the question is, why are there so many hungry people in this prosperous community? So you don't attack the problem of hunger simply by feeding folk, although you have to do that first. You begin to ask why they are hungry. A bishop of the Catholic Church in Brazil named Camara, Dom Helder Camara, once said, I can spend all day pulling people out of the river, but sooner or later I've got to go up to the river and see who is throwing them in. So the and that is a political function. That's to take a look at the root cause. Why are that many people hungry? Why are there so many people without decent health care in the United States? Why are gay and lesbian people put on the margin? What happens to our servicemen when they come home wounded? What about people who are working for less wages than they can live on? What about the dominance of the United States in world politics, in which we go off and simply take over a nation and destroy it? During the Vietnam War, we talked about destroying a village in order to save it. Now we're destroying a country in order to save it. Now, those are just a few of the myriad issues that I think Jesus was concerned about in his own day, in his own ethos, and that we need to be concerned about. There are about seven or eight others that we're going to talk about when I get out there later this week.
No, I think that's definitely important. Kind of in the way that you just described kind of addressing hunger issues, one is serving the need, whether it's directly, you know, feeding people who are hungry, etc. But I think the second part, and probably the more important part, is then looking at why there is that problem. And I think that's something that we try to apply to every situation, because you can empower people, I think, more by getting them involved in their own, the problems that they're facing, and helping them resolve the problems, helping them stand up. And so there are a lot of issues like that, that I think that's the really key part of some of the work that we're doing. And I think at the foundation, just to add to some of the issues that have been brought up, we've done a lot of work with working with unions and making sure that there's support, community support for unions, so that when they go into negotiations, they have some kind of power behind them in situations where they're being threatened. Another thing is working with university, being a campus ministry. There are a lot of issues at the university dealing with social justice, and one of them has been Chief Alanowek. There are a myriad of other issues. And one of the important things, too, is we've done a lot of work around Latin American solidarity, issues around Coca-Cola and its bottling in Colombia and in India. So there are so many issues. Basically, any time, you know, where people are being taken away the rights, where people don't have a voice, are not able to stand up for themselves, or not given that ability to stand up for themselves. That's where we need to be. And so constantly being ready to bring on new issues as they come up in the community.
I have a... Go ahead. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
As a theologian, it seems to me that the critical word in theology is the word justice. All through the Old and New Testament, the notion of justice, a Greek word called dikaiosune, which means justice or justification or righteousness, is the key word. The religious community has got to take a new look at what justice is about. Now, that's different than compassion. Compassion is finding out, compassion is feeding the hungry. Justice is finding out why they're hungry and trying to affect the social climate to change that experience. So the religious people, in at least the progressive movement, are terribly concerned about issues of justice, just as Jesus was concerned about justice, just about the Old Testament prophets were concerned about justice. That's a key word.
We are just about at our midpoint here, and I have a caller I want to get to. Why don't we do that? Someone here listening in Urbana on our line number one. Hello.
I'm sorry. I'm going to have to call back in just a minute, okay?
Okay.
Baby in need.
I see. All right. Well, that's fine. Take care of that need, and then you can call us back. Other people who are listening here, you certainly are welcome to take part in the conversation. This will give me an opportunity then to reintroduce the two guests. Joining us by telephone is Reverend Charles Bayer. He is retired Disciples of Christ minister, although, as he said, he's not a man who really is retired or retiring, I think. He now makes his home in California. He has had a number of ministerial posts, including one in Chicago, University Church in Chicago, and First Christian Church in St. Joseph, Missouri. He has talked all over the world. He's written a lot. He has done a regular column for the St. Joseph Gazette. He's written a number of books. His most recent is A Resurrected Church, published by Chalice Press. He's a founding member of the Disciples Justice Action Network. He will be here in Champaign-Urbana starting tomorrow and will be here for a couple of days. His visit here is sponsored by the Illinois Disciples Foundation. And here in studio with me is Jennifer Teabji. She's the executive director and campus minister with the Illinois Disciples Foundation. The guest here, the Reverend Bayer, will be giving a free workshop. It's open to the public. It'll take place at the Illinois Disciples Foundation, 610 East Springfield Avenue in Champaign. This will be Wednesday, 7 p.m., and as I said, it's open to anybody who is interested. Bring them to justice, putting faith into action. That's what it's called. And questions are certainly welcome. Questions, comments, welcome. All we ask of people who call in is that simply people are try to be brief in their comments just so that we can keep things moving along and get as many different people as possible. But callers are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a couple of callers here. Charleston, we'll go there. Toll free line number four. Hello.
Yes, I'll be as quickly or say what I need to say as quickly as I can. And thanks, David. It has occurred to me in the recent past and my reflection on Christianity and other religions, that humanity has not kept up, and we still display, in my opinion, the symptoms of our undeveloped psyche. We, as humans, are trapped, and religion points it up most pointedly, that we are trapped in what should be adults in upper juvenilism. And if you think of the activities of humanity in recorded history, it is they reach a point whereby they cannot exceed past the juvenile mind in an adult body, either socially or literally, in any form, and they cannot, and I wanted to give you this example. Just yesterday, I live here in Charleston, the north end of town, open farm field, adults on four-wheeled bikes, and nine-year-old boys on dirt bikes up and down and up and down, which how does an adult do that? How do we have raceways and we act like even upper children? But I guess the bottom line for me is that we advance in those four stages, infancy, childhood, juvenile, and adult. And then I am yet to meet in my long life an upper adult who really knew what they were doing. And I'll hang up and listen, and thanks, David.
All right. Well, Reverend Bayer, I don't know what you think about the metaphor that the of human development that the guest suggests, or his assessment of where we are. What do you think?
There's a lot of childishness about me. I don't want to lose. I don't want to lose my sense of enjoyment, my sense of delight, looking at things I've never seen and just Googling over them because it's so marvelous. Now, to fixate at that level, as your caller suggested, and not to move beyond that, not to see anything in terms of value as an adult would see, of course, is a terrible problem. But we're all kids at heart, at least I am. And what the church does, what religion does, it takes that childishness and lifts it up so that it can celebrate human interaction. To take the question of hunger again, somebody said that when I am hungry, it's a nutritional problem. When my neighbor is hungry, it's a spiritual problem. So the spiritual is simply not a devoid definition of the physical. It's simply taking the physical to a new level. And I think kids do pretty well at that. So I'm not all that upset about the childishness in us. I am upset about the fact that we never allow the adult to break out. We never allow the maturity to break out. And you're caller is just right. There's a lot of immature, childish stuff that adults ought to be beyond. But don't lose your sense of play. Heavens.
All right. Well, we'll get back with the caller who was calling in before from Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Jason.
Sure.
I wanted to get your guest's thoughts on the Protestant work ethic, and that seems to be something that conservatives tend to use to kind of, in my view, blame the victim when people aren't able to succeed in the system that we have set up. It's because somehow they're not working hard enough, they're not working enough hours, they're not doing the right things, they're not making the right choices. And I see that as being markedly different from in Europe, which also has tradition of Christianity, but doesn't seem to have evolved in the same way. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that, and I'll hang up and listen offline. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Ron, Reverend Bayer, can you comment on that?
Oh, I think she's right on target. The work ethic calls us to be diligent about what we do. But when people do their best, and we say, well, they're just not working hard enough, and the problem with the poor is they don't work, that's a terrible indictment, and I think Protestantism has been largely responsible for that. Let's take another current issue about that. Let's take immigration. To say people ought to work, to insist that they work, to say they ought not to be on welfare, they ought to be on work, and then to lure tens of thousands of immigrants into the United States to take our own jobs, so they will work, jobs that many Americans will not take, and then deny them health care, driver's licenses, education, and generally treating them like criminals is obscene. So we say to people around the world, you ought to work, and then we put barriers up. We say to people, you ought to take jobs, and then we supply them with minimum income jobs that they cannot live on, and we criticize them for not working, and we refuse to supply them with the kinds of things it takes to live a decent life in this country. So work is important, and people ought to work. But to blame the victim, as this woman suggests, is certainly beyond where decent spirituality ought to go.
Yeah, I think that's definitely really important. I think one of the things that you see happening, I mean, just it's a lot of hypocrisy because we do have these standards of what we expect from people in terms of work, in terms of how they can support their family, et cetera. But you go into situations where you're not making, you know, if you're making minimum wage or if you're not even making minimum wage, if you're, you know, an illegal immigrant, they're not going to give you minimum wage. And then you're not making enough money to even make a living wage in the sense where you can pay all of your bills, support your family, things like that. And so I think there's something that we really need to look at when we're putting kind of the dichotomy on. If you're successful, it's because you worked hard. If you're not successful, you didn't work hard. But we ignore some of the systemic problems that we put on it when people have to take 2-3 jobs and people have to pay for healthcare and, you know, aren't having don't have the money that they need. So I think this is one of a big issue right now when you tie in kind of the living wage, healthcare, something that's probably affecting almost all Americans, really, even now going to the middle class, probably one of the biggest issues that we have to address.
That's right. And those problems are spiritual problems. That is, it has to do with the nature of the core of human life, with the spirit in people who want to live decently, but who are blocked from it. That's a religious issue.
All right, let's talk with someone else. This is a listener in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. Going back to what you alluded to earlier in the hour about the problem of religious dominance, and myself, I often find that religion is as much a source of problems as a solution to problems. But I'm very fascinated what I see happening with a portion of the evangelical movement where I think it's Reverend Wyrick, I can't remember his name for sure, but there's a portion of the evangelicals who are showing a real concern for the environment and, you know, stewardship of the earth and concern for poor and are, you know, actively doing things to sort of make the world a better place and coming under criticism from the likes of Jerry Falwell and Dobson et al. For, you know, losing their focus, I guess. But I think that maybe you have a better idea of what, you know, fraction or percentage of the evangelicals this represents, but it seems to me that if these people really do move their support away from neocon-type Republicans and start voting for, you know, people who are trying to do something about the environment, about the poor, about war, it seems like there could be a big political shift because, I mean, if you even just peel away 10% of those people from support for the Republicans, it would have a massive electoral change take about.
Absolutely. You know, let me make a prediction that the hard political religious right is breaking up. They're beginning to look at the environment, they're beginning to look at the problems of the world, and they're doing this because evangelicals have got a pretty good biblical sense. And what they're discovering in the Bible is far more than their right-wing ideologues have told them is there. The Bible is not primarily about homosexuality, and it's not about abortion. It's about justice. It's about the world in which we live. It's about the left out and the nobodies. It's about war. And evangelicals are beginning to see that, and I think one of the great moves we're going to see in the next decade is the breakup of this hard right-wing ideological bit with Falwell and Robertson and those people, and we're going to see individuals in the evangelical movement and groups in the evangelical movement take on some of these larger issues, and your caller is exactly on target.
Well, I'm interested. I appreciate the fact that the caller brought this up, and I think that it is interesting issue, and certainly I was thinking about raising it myself, because as you say, to this point, it seems that if you take a look at people of faith who have strong religious values, who are very politically engaged, there is a definite split left-right in terms of what sort of issues they're engaged with. And as the caller said, it seems that within conservative and evangelicals, there is some number of people, and I don't know how many, but some number of people who are starting to say, we think maybe we should be paying more attention to these kinds of issues that we've talked about, social justice and the environment and so forth. And that, as the caller suggests, some people in the evangelical leadership have said, no, we need to keep our focus on things like gay marriage and abortion. And so we're starting to see, as you suggest, Reverend Bayer, something of a split going on here. Do you think, though, that it's actually would be possible now for people, you know, politically, socially engaged people of faith who are identify themselves as being sort of on the left and sort of on the right are going to be able to find some kind of common ground then to come together and get away from this left-right sort of split and say, here there are a set of issues that we can all agree on as Christians that we need to be doing something about?
I don't think it's just, I think it's more than simply possible or projection that it might happen. I think it's already happening. I talk to people across all kinds of religious lines that are terribly sensitive and tuned in to the issues of the environment, for instance. What we do to this earth, which is our home for all of us, is a profoundly religious issue, and I find folk of all kind of persuasions interested in that issue. I think it's already happening.
No, I definitely agree with that. We've definitely seen in our work just a myriad of people from so many different ends coming together to work on a certain issue. I think one of the more difficult situations is coming together to work on all the issues because ultimately it's hard to get people, I think, to line up on everything, you know, where some people are really good about working on the environment but then don't want to work on issues about gay and lesbian people, for example. Or so sometimes I think that's where I've seen a lot more tension is when you start working on a broader spectrum of issues. And I think one way to look at it, though, is that these are all interconnected, that they're all somewhat caused by the same structural setup in our society that allows for those things to happen. But I mean, there really is definitely, I think, people coming together on certain issues that people can no longer escape. There's issues like the environment and healthcare are no longer, you know, it's not just affecting, you know, a small segment of the population, but, you know, lower class, middle class people, upper middle class are feeling these things. People are feeling, you know, the price when you go to the gas station. People are feeling having to pay for healthcare or not having healthcare. And so I think we do have these certain issues that are bringing people together across different bonds to work on and address them.
I have another caller I want to get to in just a second here, but I also want to remind people listening, we have about 10 minutes left in this hour of focus, and I would again like to very quickly introduce the guests. Joining us by telephone, the Reverend Charles Bayer. He is a retired Disciples of Christ minister. He now makes his home in California and has had ministerial posts a number of places, including Chicago and St. Joseph, Missouri. He's a founding member of the Disciples Justice Action Network. He has done a lot of speaking and writing. He's authored several books. His most recent is A Resurrected Church, Christianity After the Death of Christendom. He's going to be here in Champaign-Urbana spending a couple of days. His visit sponsored by the Illinois Disciples Foundation. We'll be giving a workshop, free and open to the public, on Wednesday night at 7 at the Illinois Disciples Foundation, entitled Bring Them to Justice, Putting Faith into Action. And also here in studio with me is Jennifer Teabji. She is the executive director and campus minister with the IDF, Illinois Disciples Foundation. Questions here, welcome. Do keep in mind, though, that we're coming down here to about our last 10 minutes, so it will help us if people can be brief. Here's a caller in Bloomington, Indiana, next, line 4. Hello.
Hi. We have a threat from militant Muslims, from the Ayatollah Khomeini to the most current sermon in last Friday's mosque. They are intent on they want a world caliphate. In other words, they want to take over the world. They want to conquer the world. They have said so. And they are willing to resort to the most appalling moral depravity to achieve their goal. Reverend, tell me how we're going to solve this problem.
Well, the problem you have in Islam is the same problem you have in Christianity. There is a fundamentalist streak running through that religion, just like there's a fundamentalist streak in running through the Christian religion.
How are we going to prevent them from taking over the world?
Well, I think we have to realize that they're a minority of Muslims, just like they're a minority of Christians who want to take over the world. I mean, if you want to talk about taking over the world, the group that wants to take over the world is the American political, military, industrial complex.
Let's stay on the subject. This minority of Muslims that want to take over the world have the majority of Muslims pretty well intimidated.
Don't think that's true. I think that that's a bit of propaganda that you often hear from the American right. If you take a look around the world, that is not the case. The Muslim minority that's fundamentalist is very difficult, and they are a severe problem. But most of the Muslims in the world, at least all those that I know, are very much committed to the same sorts of issues that we're committed to. They're not committed to violence. Violence and treachery are outside the Quran. But if you want to take a look at religion, it has its dark side and its light side, and its difficult side always comes through fundamentalism.
Well, now let me agree with you in the fact that there are a number of Muslims that oppose the militant Muslims, but right now the militant Muslims have those more peaceful Muslims pretty well intimidated, and if those more peaceful Muslims don't have our help, the militants are going to win.
Well, that's true, but you know, what about the American right wing religionist as being destructive of human value? Who's going to be afraid of them? People all around the world are scared to death.
You keep
of American right wing religionists.
Come on, stay on the subject. We got a Muslim problem, and they're militant, and they are intimidating the world, and they want to have a world caliphate. How do we solve this problem?
We've got a religious problem in people from the right wing, no matter if they're Christians or Muslims.
I want Jen here in the studio wants to get in a word. I want to give her a chance to do that.
Yeah, I want to echo, I think, what Reverend Baer was saying. I think definitely there's the issue of fundamentalism and the use of violence sometimes to put forth that fundamentalism is something that comes across in all religions. I can say, growing up Roman Catholic and Muslim, that from my experiences, seeing different aspects of both religions, definitely there are a lot of more similarities than differences, and the differences are what people are trying to focus on now. But there's definitely a message that our government wants us to think about Muslims in the world. But the Muslims that our caller was referring to is a very small segment, and I don't think that the Muslims in general can be characterized in the way that he had characterized them. I think they're the same as us. It's really no different than some of the situations that Christianity has.
Let me get this.
Is your caller still on the line?
I can put him back on the line, yeah.
What I'd like to know from him is, does he know any Muslims? And who are they? And what's his relationship with them? Because the way we understand people is face-to-face and person-to-person. And I just wonder if he knows any.
Well, I don't know any Muslims personally, but I have read the history of the Muslim religion, and it is a militant history. They win converts by military conquest. They always have. They almost conquered Spain. They almost conquered Vienna.
Have you ever heard about the Crusades and where the Christians tried to conquer that whole part of the world? I mean, that goes with religion. It's not necessarily Muslim. It's the way religious fundamentalists tend to operate. Christianity has been terribly aggressive. The whole colonial movement was an aggressive movement. So you can't blame it on Muslims. You have to look at the whole nature of religion. Now, religion's also got its positive sides. In fact, they're very much more important. So both religions have got positive and negative aspects to them.
Yeah.
So if you're going to take a look in the mirror, you're going to see Christianity doing the same thing you've accused the Muslims of doing.
We just got about 5 minutes left. I'm going to have to intervene here, as I know that we all are not, the callers and the guests are not going to come to any meeting of the minds here. So we're simply going to have to go on. I do have some other callers. I just wanted to ask Jen a question. Let me get this straight. You have one parent who's Muslim and one parent who's Catholic?
Yes, I do. My parents don't practice heavily anymore. I mean, they're spiritual people, but they don't practice in terms of organized religion. And so growing up, I had both sides to kind of it was interesting. That's pretty much all I can say. And was actually turned away from religion for a long time because of some of my experiences. But, you know, now I am a campus minister. I'm a licensed minister through the Disciples of Christ. And one of the things that attracted me to Disciples of Christ is just it's more openness, acceptance of people. So it was definitely a very interesting experience. But I was able to see the similarities more so than the differences between the two.
Okay. We'll try to get at least one or two more callers in. We have somebody in Ford County on line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. Well, I had a question when I first or a comment, but I wanted to comment on Christians and Muslims. And I've had been able to meet Muslims in the West Bank, and they are the most peace-loving people. And I've also met along with some Jewish peace activists too. So yeah, get to know people of other faiths. I think that was a good comment. I'm just really enjoying this segment of your program, David. And I guess that I found out that there's a lot of things done in the name of religion that are wrong, and sometimes they're the ones that get the highlight. But get to know each other. I guess it just upsets me when people talk about Muslims and when we as Christians have really not been as faithful to Jesus as we should have been should be, and. The other comment I have, and I was going to call about in the first place, was when Robertson basically said, let's kill Venezuela's president, Chavez. And I mean, it just horrified me that that was said, and I didn't feel like there was a whole lot done about that. And I thought, I don't want Robertson representing me as a Christian. And I just want your comment on that, and I'll hang up and listen.
All
Thank
right.
you.
Well, Reverend Bayer, you can comment on any of that you like.
Yeah, I like the whole thing. Yes, you have to meet people individually in order to do it. You can read the prejudice literature on every side and realize that every religion has problems. But when you get face-to-face with folks and sit down with them and try to understand where they're coming from, it's a different world.
All right. Well, let's talk with somebody else here. Rantoul, line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
I got in the last part of the radio context, but I was going to say, my dad was a university professor and research scientist, and I grew up with Muslim people as a young child. I'm 58 years old, and when we went on vacation or holiday, we frequently went and visited them, the ones that settled here in the United States, and I happen to like Muslim people. Now, I bought my Quran almost 20 years ago. I was interested in it. Long before people became interested in it. And it takes careful study of the Quran. And I also study the Bible. I study the second great rabbinical Bible, Hebrew Masoretic text, and the Koine Greek received text of the New Testament. And I have a pretty good context of... Now, I haven't studied the Hadith, but I do know that Muslim people, the majority of them in the world, are wonderful people. They want to do right. And it's the extremists. That I would say they're essentially irrational people, and extremists in any form of religion. Now, I personally am a conservative Christian that I believe and trust Jesus Christ as my personal Savior. It's a relationship between me and Him, and that's what I look at it. I also like to tell other people that He died on the cross to pay for their sins, and that's what Easter is coming up. But there is a difference between Muslim people and the Muslim religion. And there's parts of the Muslim religion that are extremist, and there are extremists in a Christian religion. They may take the Christian religion and hide behind it, like Christian identity groups. You shall see them by their fruit. Look at their fruit and study what doctrines are they practicing. How much of the Holy Scriptures do they really know? I mean, I talk for hours on this subject, but I just wanted to comment that there's a difference between the religion and the people and how they practice it.
Well,
that's the only thing I can say. I love Muslim people. In fact, I carry a picture with me, a former retired economics minister of the country of Egypt. It's one of my dad's graduate students.
Yeah,
and I tell people, say, don't give me that garbage. I've learned every culture in the world. You know, I love people.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. I'm going to have to jump in here because we're really close to the end. And again, I don't know, Reverend Bayer, you want to comment at all on what the guest had, or what the caller had to say?
I'd just like to listen to him a little more. I think he's right on.
We're just about at the point here that we're going to have to finish, and I'm sorry we have somebody else that we can't take, but we're just really down to the end of the time. One more time, I would like to mention for people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana that if you would like to hear more from our guest, Charles Bayer, Reverend Charles Bayer, he will be here spending a couple of days, his visit sponsored by the Illinois Disciples Foundation, and there will be a talk he'll be giving on Wednesday night at 7 at the Foundation, Illinois Disciples Foundation, 610 East Springfield in Champaign. And it's at 7, and it's open to the public, talking about putting faith into action. So anybody who would like to attend should feel welcome. Jen, here in the studio with me, also Jen Teabji. She's the executive director of Campus Minister. Anything else about this or anything else that you'd like to get in before we have to go?
Well, just thank you very much for having us. The event on Wednesday is also it's free, so people should definitely come. It's on bus lines, a lot of the bus lines, and there is some parking, and it's wheelchair accessible. And I hope you guys enjoyed the show.
All right. Well, and Reverend Bayer, to you, I want to say thanks very much for giving us some of your time. We certainly appreciate it.
Thank you, David, and Jen, I'll see you tomorrow.
Well, I'll see you tomorrow, too.
All right, and if you would be interested in reading the most recent book by our guest, Reverend Charles Bayer, I'll mention that one more time. It's A Resurrected Church, Christianity After the Death of Christendom. It's available on paperback. It's published by the Chalice Press.